Welcome to Health Literacy Out Loud. I'm Helen Osborne, President of Health Literacy Consulting, founder of Health Literacy Month, and your host of Health Literacy Out Loud. In these podcasts, you get to listen in on my conversations with some really remarkable people, hearing what health literacy is, why it matters, and ways all of us can help improve health understanding. Today, I'm talking with Tom Mucciolo, who is president of MediaNet, Inc., a presentation skills company based in New York City. For many years, Tom has been helping leaders effectively communicate their messages using scripting, visual design, and delivery skills. He also is on the faculty at NYU. Tom writes extensively about teaching and presentation effectiveness and is co-author of the book, A Guide to Better Teaching. Welcome, Tom.
Hello, Helen. How are you? Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I met you when I was at the annual conference of the National Speakers Association, and you were leading a workshop about using nonverbal gestures in presentations. I learned so much from you that day, and I've tried to put it in my presentations ever since. And I've also since realized that what you were talking about applies to health communication as well, too. Let's take this one from the top. Why is good communication a matter of gestures, not just our words?
Yeah, I would look at the communication into two sections of a person's style. One of it's verbal, the other is nonverbal. So the verbal skills are actually the content itself, and then the nonverbal skills are the tone of voice, the visual cues we get if we can see someone. So imagine that these two things are the components of any type of communication with another person, part of it being what you said and the other part being what you looked like when you said it.
Okay, so in healthcare, we're always talking to people. Often it's in that person-to-person interaction. But sometimes it's not, and sometimes health communicators also speak to large groups. How can we use those? Well, what are gestures? What do you mean when you say gestures?
Well, I guess what I think the best way to separate it is to look at the concept of the difference between conversation and presentation.
Okay.
And imagine that a conversation between two people is basically either person can take control of the conversation at any point. So if you and I are having a cup of coffee and I'm looking out somehow of a window and I say, you know, Helen, I'm looking at that new car across the street. I'm thinking of getting a new car. You could not have predicted that. It was a conversation. I decided to throw it in because I saw the car.
Oh, okay.
So imagine that the concept is, how predictable is conversation? And generally, it really isn't. 50% of everything you say is what you look like when you say it, and the other 50% is what you said. So the verbal and nonverbal cues, if you want to use that term, are equal in conversation because either party can change the direction and can contribute.
Okay. I'm thinking of health communication. It's really not an equal-to-equal conversation, nor is a presentation.
I would move that into the presentation side by saying, okay, somebody has prepared something. Let's say a clinician has already got experience. Some patient record history has ability to say, I'm going to talk on a subject that the patient doesn't really know as much about.
Okay.
So imagine that that would allow a person who is communicating to have one side of the coin or one piece of this puzzle completed while the other one doesn't. We call this prepared speech. This would be no different than when you send me an email, I'm going to read it for the first time, but you've already prepared it. So in a conversation, if you're a clinician, you already kind of know what you want to say about a particular health matter. I'm just waiting to hear how it applies to me. This changes the dynamic of what we start to observe. What used to be verbal, nonverbal being half and half, it skews this ratio dramatically.
In what way?
Well, some studies indicate that a very high percentage is nonverbal, like over 55% of it could be what you look like when you say it, 38% more how you actually deliver it, leaving 7% to be the content. An over 90% and under 10% ratio of the nonverbal to the verbal.
That's astounding to me. What can we do about it?
Well, it doesn't mean the content's not important. It certainly is, but it has to be the right content. So we're dealing with quality of content, not quantity. And that leaves the nonverbal cues. So people will begin to judge how the person looked when they said it, what their mannerisms were. Did they look appealing, inviting? And this is why the nonverbal cues become a skill. And imagine the fact that the greater you are in predictability, meaning I understand what you're saying even before you almost say it, the clearer the impact of the message. I'll give you a perfect example. If you were asking me a question as to whether I wanted a drink of water, let's assume there's only two answers to this question. You're waiting for me to give you an answer. So the message I'm about to deliver of whether I want a drink of water is the unpredictable part. You don't know what I'm going to say.
Okay.
But if I do say yes, and I nod my head up and down, the nonverbal action of my head and even the word yes are congruent. Hence, the action is quite predictable. But if I were to move my head side to side and still say yes, you might not be sure what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because they were incongruent or unpredictable. So when people present information where they have pre-planned knowledge,
yeah,
the receiver looks for predictable actions that are nonverbal, and those actions are what they use to interpret the message itself.
Okay, Tom, my world's in healthcare. Our listeners are all involved in this kind of health communication. Now, let's kind of think of this, maybe about test results or something.
Okay.
So you're talking with a patient and the results are not what the patient wants to hear. How can you use other than your words to communicate that clearly, but perhaps also so show some empathy or caring or hope?
Yeah, in reality, once you know that the body's language or the nonverbal cues will dominate in this situation, you can work on three possible things in that body's language that would make the other person have a reaction, hopefully in a very positive way, if you're using these skills correctly. One issue is proximity, another issue is openness, and a third issue is invitation. And I'll briefly explain them.
Okay.
Proximity is very simple, the distance we are from one another. And of course, as two people get closer together, the level of intimacy rises. And it's not like you're going to be dancing with someone. But a lot of times this happens with the distance someone stands away or the distance someone uses their head to back away or come closer to us. So imagine if your head, just your head alone, wanted to create a bigger picture for someone. The tendency would be to tilt the head slightly backward, away from the person, and this would give someone a bigger view of what you're about to say. And many people use this to talk about, a lot of studies show, information in the field has this evidence, and sometimes the tilt of the head away is a larger perspective.
You're not talking about dramatic gestures here. You're talking about a slight shift.
That's right. Very slight moves of the head, would change the level of proximity. The literature likes to use the word immediacy. How immediate is the person to me? Can I ask them a question? Can I feel like they're close to me? Like, do they have a friendliness about them or approachability?
Okay, Tom, when we're talking about proximity, you're talking about the head and kind of that small little movement we might make. Does it deal with the whole body too, or just the head?
Absolutely. Yeah, in a setting where I'm not just one-to-one with someone who's sitting 3 feet away from me, but I'm standing in front of a small group, then it would be movement of the body. If the body's farther away from the audience, that tends to be that farther back move of the body, tends to be focused on something larger, perhaps.
Oh, okay. Actually, I remember seeing you do this in the workshop, and you actually took the stage. We were in your audience, and you talked about where your body would go when you make your grander points or where you want to be a little bit more conversational or engaging of the audience.
Exactly. And usually as you get closer to an audience, that that style of more personal attachment will rise. The level of immediacy raises, or intimacy with the audience. So a person who's standing can move closer to someone to create this degree of proximity, this immediacy, or be farther away from them. And even a head tilt towards someone would be much more personal than a head tilt away. And sometimes clinicians, by making conversation with patients, sometimes tend to play what I call big picture. The head tilts back when they speak, yet the patient who's vulnerable may have been looking for the head tilting forward.
Interesting.
And that's just an action of the body that would have been congruent with some type of closeness to the person. You don't want to pretend to make this happen. This has to be something out of someone's nature.
But can it be learned, too?
Absolutely.
Okay. So you talked about proximity. You also talked about openness. What's that?
Yeah, the degree of openness is really where your shoulders exist. The degree your shoulders face someone else's shoulders. So if I'm standing across from just one other person, and my shoulders are basically matching their shoulders, as if you could draw, you know, two straight lines from each of our shoulders matching, that would put us at a high degree of openness for both of us at the same time. That's a difficult position to be in because your bodies are both in what we call power positions of the body.
I mean, you're really looking straight at that person, right?
Yeah, your body's facing them straight on.
Okay.
You could be looking at them. That's not a problem, but it's the shoulders that we're dealing with. However, if one shoulder is slightly back, imagine the body being at a 45-degree angle to another person. You could still be looking at them with your head, but the body's angle is away. The degree of openness has shifted back slightly so that one shoulder is closer to them than another. And this is what we call a rest position of the body, which means it's less, I don't want to use the word threatening, but it's less impact. And this would be no different than the concept of voice, where voice could get very loud if it needs to, but tends not to get loud all the time.
And I've tried using some of that in my presentations based on what I saw with you, where I'm not looking absolutely straight on an audience, but I tilt my body just a little bit.
Yeah, the openness issue, a lot of times, especially when people are presenting content, because they might have a slide, for example. So if the body can be at a 45-degree angle to audience and slide, then the body is open to content and open to people. It's only when we'd like impact where we would square the body to the back of the space if it was a group, and that creates a power position for the audience to say, wow, this must be slightly more impactful or more important.
Oh, that's interesting. I'm almost thinking of this almost like punctuation, like we wouldn't write in all capitals, we wouldn't use all exclamation marks. It's that varying it back and forth that engages the other person.
That is critical to the delivery skill, and which is why you'll even see this on the news at night where the two anchors are angled to one another. But when the lead story comes in, there's a squared off shot, a little picture over the shoulder.
Wow, I'm learning. I know. I wanted to ask you about that other point about invitation.
Yeah, invitation is really the most powerful of all skills, is the ability for someone to feel that they can trust you.
Okay.
And trust in the body, in the nonverbal cue of the body, one form of trust does exist in the face with the smile, for example. But another form of trust is even more of a body language issue, which is the open palm. How often does a person use an open gestured, open palm to another person? We do this in the Western culture very quickly with a handshake when we greet someone.
Open palm is your palm is straight up.
Well, it's open. It doesn't, you don't want to make it look too harsh, like it's a karate chop.
Okay.
But it's more of an open gesture. Your fingers are relaxed, but it's when the palm opens to someone, it looks like you're extending an invitation to communicate. And especially for groups, a lot of times you might have a group of people, if you ask a question and you never made any inviting gestures like these open palms to show the group that they all can communicate, most people will reliably predict that your last look, whoever you looked at last, has to answer a question because they went off where you were looking. But if you make gestures, if the palm opens to the group, both hands are open to the group saying how many of you agree with this, the group knows, well, this person must be talking to all of us. But it would even work one-to-one because when there's an open palm to someone, it's almost as if you're handing them a gift.
Mm-hmm.
And that invitation is so critical to allowing someone to speak, for example, or holding someone from continuing to speak.
And that's a tip I learned from you that I've actually used more than probably the other ones. It's the easiest to remember and the easiest to manage. It makes such a big difference. Also, listening to you, as an aside from this, I have a little toddler grandbaby. Her favorite book is Head, Shoulders, Knees, and Toes. That sounds like what you're talking about. Pay attention to your head, shoulders, knees, toes, palms. It all makes a difference.
Yeah, and those would be the nonverbal things. And a lot of times you'll see this in a person's body's language where someone's response might be, well, I didn't get a good feeling when I talked to that person, or they, you know, it just didn't make me feel right. And they can't really put their finger on what it was other than it didn't feel right.
Mm-hmm.
Chances are it was some type of nonverbal action that did not appear congruent or consistent with the words they were hearing.
Okay, Tom, we have a challenge, you and I and our listeners, all of us. We're not looking at each other. I haven't seen you in 6 months. What can we do when we're communicating when there is no visual cue?
When there's no visual cue, now about 85% of the communication is tone of voice.
Okay.
And it could have to do with the ability to avoid distractions. A typical distraction in conversation is not a problem for people, which would be a filler, the. Don't worry about that in a conversation because the nonverbal and verbal cues are very equal. But in prepared speech, these distractions, these sounds we make in between the words we say will be noticed. They will be picked up, not to a tremendous degree, but the sound may be something that affects people. Another example would be a parenthetical intrusion. I know it's a big phrase, but it's drifting away from the content that you started with. So if you asked me a question that said, Tom, what do you think about the weather?
Mm-hmm.
I could have said, the weather has been pretty bad lately where I live. That's pretty simple. But what if I had said, the weather? Well, don't get me started on a topic like the weather. Topics are things that are distracting. In fact, the most distracting topic could be about animals. And, you know, I don't even have any pets.
Right.
But pets are, some people love pets. Meanwhile, I haven't even gotten to the original question.
So you have to stay focused on what you're doing.
Yeah, one way to do it is to establish presence in speech. And this can be done very quickly. If someone asks you a question and you answer it, followed by an explanation, you have a high degree of presence. If you explain and then answer, your degree of presence is dropping.
Can you give an example?
An example would be very simple. I go to the doctor and I notice my blood sugar is high. I say to the doctor, can I have a Coke for lunch?
Mm-hmm.
The doctor can say, no, and here's why. Your blood sugar is high. The doctor could say, well, you know, a lot of people like different types of soft drinks. And there's debate of which kind of soft drinks, better, worse. In my opinion, I would probably not go with the Coke. That's weaker.
Oh, okay.
So you have to decide how much strength do you want in presence when you choose to respond to something. I prefer power when people speak with prepared speech. They should answer a question immediately followed by an explanation, rather than hedge, unless it's a debatable topic.
Okay. And if it's debatable, could you say, that's a debatable topic, experts don't agree on it?
Yeah, debatable topics are opinion. Opinion is debatable topics.
Okay.
Well, do you think people should be able to vote at the age of 15?
Mm-hmm.
And then someone says, you know, there's a lot of debate on what age someone can make a rational decision as an adult. That's a debatable argument versus, do you think a six-year-old should drive a car? You'd say, absolutely not.
Okay. So, Tom, you've told us about the presence, the gestures, the tone, the physical part. You've shared so much. I think these tips alone, if all of us just put them into place in our communication, I think we could keep moving the dialogue further along. Is there any way people can learn more about this?
Yes, they're welcome to visit my website, which is MediaNet-NY.com or MediaNet-NY.com.
Okay, great. We'll have that on your Health Literacy Out Loud page.
The way to think of what we said, Helen, just briefly, is in one sentence, you could say that nonverbal skill requires a high degree of predictability in order to create the unexpected, which is the message itself. So you really have to be very predictable.
And that's what we're doing. And I thank you for being predictable, engaging, and informative. I hope all the listeners of Health Literacy Out Loud learned as much from you as I did. So thank you, Tom.
Thank you, Helen.
I learned so much from Tom Mucciolo about using gestures and tone and all those things we do in communication beyond our words. But communicating clearly and effectively isn't so easy. For help clearly communicating your health message, please visit my Health Literacy Consulting website at www.healthliteracy.com. And while you are there, sign up for the free monthly e-newsletter, What's New in Health Literacy Consulting. New Health Literacy Out Loud podcasts come out every few weeks. Subscribe for free to hear them all. You can find more information along with important links at www.healthliteracyoutloud.org. Did you like this podcast? Did you learn something new? If so, tell your colleagues, tell your friends. Together, let's let the whole world know why health literacy matters. Until next time, I'm Helen Osborne.